Halo, selamat datang ke Teoflogi. Kita hari ini akan ada tamu spesial, Dr. Joshua Ralston, dan diskusinya akan bahasa Inggris. Ini mengenai an engagement with Syariah. Okay, so I'd like to welcome everybody to Teoflogi. This is an Indonesian channel, but today we have a special guest, Dr. Joshua Ralston. He is the reader in Christian-Muslim Relations, the School of Divinity at Edinburgh, director and co-founder of the Christian Muslim Studies Network, funded by the Henry Luce Foundation. He has published widely in Reformed Theology, Christian Theological Engagements with Islam, Arab Christianity, and on Political Theology. So today he will talk about his monograph, Law and the Rule of God, A Christian Engagement with Sharia, which was published in Cambridge Press in 2020, just last year. So this is a very new book. And we're very excited to have him. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Ralston and all the Teoflogi moderators now. Oops, one person's missing. So here we have several guests. Elia from Manchester, Anga here in Jakarta, and Hans in the US, and also Nindyo here in the Black Box in New York, and of course Dr. Ralston in Edinburgh. So Nindyo, are you in yet? Okay,
all right. Am I disappeared?
Yes, your video is off. But it's all right.
We can hear you.
So, welcome, Josh, to Teoflogi. So, you've been to Indonesia several years ago, you said.
Yeah, it was actually 4 years ago at this very time that I was in Indonesia, the only time I've ever visited. We were in Jakarta for 4 or 5 days, and then in Jogja for 3 or 4 days, doing stuff to link the University of Edinburgh, especially Islamic studies, with different institutions in Indonesia, both through the government as well as different universities. But I also had the opportunity to visit the Jakarta Theological Seminary and give a paper on Christology. So it's really nice to be back, although given the freezing cold outside, I would much rather be in Indonesia right now than here in Edinburgh. If you can tell from my accent, I'm an American, and in fact from Southern California, so I'm used to the sun, and would love to be in Indonesia right now instead of freezing. So,
well, welcome, Josh. Would you like to present some materials, talk about it, or do you want me to kick you off with a question?
Yeah, so I thought, since most of you won't be familiar with the book or with the work, that it might just be helpful to lay out some of my thinking and what was behind the book before then we can get into some of the questions about the details, or more broadly, my approach to Christian theological engagement with Islam. The book just came out about a year ago, Law and the Rule of God, A Christian Engagement with Sharia. As you'll know, being in or from Indonesia, the question of Sharia is one of the biggest and most important political and, I will also argue, theological issues in the post-colonial era. Particular questions in Muslim-majority countries about how the Sharia, or as often translated, Islamic law, although I don't think that's the best translation, relates to national law. And if you look around the Muslim majority world, you have a variety of models of how to do this. In some countries, they claim to explicitly endorse the Sharia through the apparatus of the state. So think here of Sudan, or of Iran to a different extent, or Saudi Arabia. You have other models, like in Egypt, where the Sharia is said to be something like the moral source of the law, although not the actual enacted law, although the individual legal traditions of Sharia are still present. And in that sense, it's not totally dissimilar to the nation state of Israel, who often also says that Jewish law is the national law or the moral source of the law, but that the state is still secular. And then you have other models who claim, like, for instance, the Tunisian government, which has enacted a new constitution that doesn't include the word Sharia. Of course, in Indonesia, you had a similar debate with the foundation of the post-colonial state and the different models of, I know, never pronounce it correctly, Pancasila, as a cultural idea. So there's a whole bunch of different ways of thinking about this. And there's a lot of literature out there about Sharia and the state, Sharia and secularism. However, I was troubled, let's say, or curious, that there was very little Christian theological engagement with Sharia. And there was a tendency to turn either away from engaging with it by appealing to things like justice and saying, well, we should focus on justice instead of the Sharia. However, that's a deeply problematic idea because, of course, law and justice are intertwined with one another. And at the same time, this sort of quick appeals to secularism as the solution, whether that was in a Muslim-majority context or whether that's in the West, where there is arguments with Muslims who have citizenship in, say, France or Germany or the United States, didn't seem sufficient either. And so the book is an attempt to think about Sharia first and foremost theologically and not sociologically or politically. It's trying to engage with Sharia as what I call in the book theo-legal discourse. That isn't to deny the really important and vital questions about Sharia in the state, but it is to locate them in a broader tradition of debate and discourse. And so I try to not focus on questions like political establishment, thimmihood, freedom of religion, blasphemy laws. Obviously, this was a big issue in Jakarta, what was it, 4 years ago or so? Although those are really important, but to begin by taking a step backwards, and I have the privilege of being able to do this in a way that may be different for some of my friends who are Egyptian Christians or Jordanian Christians or Indonesian Christians, where the context is slightly different. So I do want to recognize that, and maybe we can get into that in the Q&A a bit, and to say, what would it mean for me as a Christian theologian to take the appeal of Sharia seriously and to engage with Islamic thought about it? And so to do that, I develop a model of what I call comparative political theology, which draws together comparative theology, which is an attempt to what Frank Clooney calls faith-seeking understanding across religious boundaries. I see Hans is an expert on this as well. And so to engage with another religious tradition on its own terms, asking what questions, challenges, ideas it brings back to me as a Christian theologian, but to also bring that into conversation with political theology, especially the ways in which political theology attempts to look at how concepts like sovereignty, justice, the exception, are formed and framed in the dynamics between the political and the theological, and to include Islam in this. Often Western scholarship is focused either on Christianity or secularism or post-secular in its political theological discourse, and to say, what if we did this and engage in these ways? And in the process of doing that, I won't get into the whole book. Maybe you can recommend it to your library. I try to take seriously the importance of Sharia for Muslim practice and Islamic political thought. And part of that is to recognize that if we're going to have constructive interreligious engagement that moves beyond either polemics or simple recognition of difference, we need to address the heart of our religious, theological, political, and social beliefs and practices. And to not engage Sharia would be akin to engaging in Christian-Muslim dialogue and asking Christians to not talk about Jesus or the Trinity or the gospel, right? It is at the heart of many. I'm not saying that's all Islam is, but it's deeply embedded in Muslim ideas and practices. And in fact, just like Christology, just like the Trinity, just like Christian social ethics, Muslims have, for 1400 years and continuing this day, a wide variety of interpretations, understandings, and debates about Sharia, both in terms of how it's practiced in one's own individual piety, but also in how it relates to political and governmental rulers. So that was one reason. The second was an awareness that appeals to secularism, although I kind of defend a version of political secularism later in the book, but appeals to an ardent secularism as the solution is insufficient to address and engage with what is a dominant Islamic political idea, especially in the post-colonial period. And then finally, I also wanted to say Muslims for 1400 years have been addressing Christians and addressing Christians in our discourse, especially about law, ethics, justice, and politics. And if you engage with Sharia not only as a problem of politics, but as a vision for living life in submission to God, right? So hence the title, Law and the Rule of God, that Muslims intellectually have raised significant questions about Christian theology and practice. So in the third chapter of the book, I essentially try to lay out what are the critiques that Muslim thinkers throughout the centuries have put to Christians about our theology of law. So much of the discourse has been about Christians or secularists critiquing Muslim views of Sharia, which I think there's a place for, and I want to encourage that in the end. But what is lost in that is, I think, extremely incisive critiques that Muslim thinkers have towards Christians about our theology of law. And so I look at a number of figures. I look at the Quran itself. I look at someone like Ibn Hazm or Abdul Jabbar, who are very early thinkers and who essentially argue that Christianity has corrupted its practice from that of Jesus, right? So Paul is usually the culprit. So the fact that Christians, for instance, eat pork, don't fast as regularly, don't have ritual practices that are the same as Jesus, they see as innovations. These aren't that difficult to handle. But what becomes interesting for me is that later this develops, especially in the thinker Ibn Taymiyyah, who is often considered, wrongly so, but a sort of proto-Salafist. Ibn Taymiyyah died in 1328 or so, Western calendar, correct me if I'm wrong, but somewhere in the 1320s or 1330s. And he wrote a 1,000-word critique of Christianity called Al-Jawab As-Sahih, which is a response to an Arab Christian comment. And in that, he goes through a whole bunch of critiques of Christianity, the incarnation, reason and revelation, etc. But one of them is about the law and the gospel, essentially. And he argues that the Christian author had said there's two kinds of sharias. Interesting here that a Christian is talking about Sharia, right, for their own use. And this is quite common amongst medieval Arab Christians. They talk about Shariat al-Injil, the Sharia of the Gospel, Shariat al-Masahi, a Sharia of the Messiah, or a Sharia of the Christians. And so the Christian author had said there's two kinds of Sharia, a Shariat al-Adl, which for you, it means the Sharia of justice, which he equates with the Torah and Moses. And then there's a Shariat al-Fadl, or a way of mercy or grace. And of course, the Sharia of mercy and grace for the Christian author is what we have. It's the higher one. It's a sign of Jesus's coming, of overturning justice. And there's three, actually, Muslims who responded to this letter. One in Cairo, one in Damascus, and then another one, Ibn Taymiyyah, in Damascus. And Ibn Taymiyyah is the only one who says, actually, no, there's not two laws. There's a third. A Shariat al-Karim, or a Sharia of perfection. And essentially, the Christian author had said, once you have Jesus, you don't need Muhammad, you don't need the law. And what Ibn Taymiyyah says is, actually, you do. Because what Jesus was doing wasn't trying to replace justice, but to offer a correction, right? And what the Christians did is take it so far to the other side that Christian practice is now completely devoid of justice. And what Christians now do is they have two laws. They have a law for the ruler, in which the ruler says that natural law and the divine right of kings means we can do what we want. Look at Romans 13, obey me. But then the poor are given the law of Jesus and told to turn the other cheek, right? And so what ends up happening, according to Ibn Taymiyyah, is that Christian theology of law lacks a coherent account of political justice, because the rulers can say, obey me, and the poor are told to give up their rights of justice. And I find, he goes on at longer length about this, but I think it's an extremely powerful critique in how he lays it out. For those of you that know Luther or Two Kingdoms theologies, it's almost as if he's critiquing Luther before Luther exists. And I look at this critique and then connect it to 20th century Muslim thinkers who connect this to debates about secularism. Said Qutb, who's an Islamist, Al-Attas, who's a Malaysian, and Said Hussein Nasser, who's a Shia, more mystic. And what's interesting is while all three of them come from very different perspectives on Islam, all three of them say that the problem of Christianity is that we don't have a coherent Sharia, that we don't have a coherent Christian ethic that is grounded in our central claims about revelation and Jesus. And long story short, I actually think they're mostly right. And so the book tries to say, if they're mostly right, why is this the case for Western Christians? And how might I address it? And the book then tries to unfold a perspective about public theologies of law that is deeply rooted to the particularity of Christianity, but avoids appeals to either Two Kingdoms or natural law. Long story short, I think that what I end up diagnosing through a study of Justin Martyr, Thomas Aquinas, and Martin Luther is that the natural law and public law is what I call quarantined from the gaze of the gospel. That Judaism and ancient Israel's law is fundamentally revised and critiqued in light of Jesus of Nazareth. But that same application is not given to natural law or public law. And in the sixth chapter, I use a case in point being the crucifixion. Here is an act of public law that is deeply unjust, carried out by Romans in concert with some Jewish leaders, that is said to be a just law. And so I attempt to say, well, what might we do to think about this problem? And again, I encourage you to read the book, but through dialogue with both Karl Barth, Wolfhard Pannenberg, Kathy Tanner, and a few others, I developed my own account of law as what I call a provisional indirect witness to the rule of God. And I can go through those in the Q&A if we want. And I actually say that this concept of thinking about law as a provisional witness to the rule of God, something that we're always grasping for but never can hold on to, gives us a way to engage with some Muslim debates about law and the rule of God. And then I turn in the concluding section to look at some of these Muslim debates, and I raise up certain Muslim voices, prominent ones in the Arabs context. I don't know other Muslim majority languages other than Arabic, so I look at Arabic texts, and particularly those Muslim thinkers who use debates about the sovereignty of God not to enforce a state-enforced Sharia, but think about Sharia as a more ambiguous thing that we're always grasping for. So, for instance, Muhammad Abdul Al-Jabari, who is a Moroccan philosopher, who talks about Sharia as something that has always outstretched us, right? Something that pulls us forward. And I also look at some classical Muslim thinkers who distinguish between the Sharia as a divine reality of perfect justice and fiqh, which is the human interpretation of it, a human quest for it, and look at the ways in which some of this deeper tradition of Islamic thought recognizes the epistemic humility necessary in any human judgment. So in classical Islamic Sharia, not all, but many, would end with the phrase Allahu A'lam, which means, but God knows best, right? So my judgment is a, as I argue, an indirect witness to God's rule. It isn't God's rule in and of itself. And I try to suggest this gives us a way into affirming some aspects of what Muslims are getting at, but also critiquing other aspects of Muslim practice in a what constructive and critical dialogue. And I conclude by suggesting that really what we need to be thinking about is not the Sharia as a whole, because no Muslim is going to accept critique of that, but the fiqh and human interpretations and applications of it, and that this should be done on an ad hoc basis, right? So rather than throwing out the whole thing or affirming the whole thing, we engage in concrete judgments, which is much more what fiqh is anyway. So for instance, Hans, who's on here, gave a very interesting paper, I think it's been published somewhere, on a debate that happened in Indonesia about whether or not you could wear Christmas hats, right? And in his paper, he rightfully showed that the more compelling way to engage with this wasn't by appealing to Pancasila or secularism, but to look at the incoherence within the Muslim's own Islamic tradition, right? Like that, he can correct me if I'm misreading his position, but that by engaging in something of saying, look, even on hadith and fiqh terms, your argument doesn't plan out, right? And so I'm not saying that all of us need to become jurists, but I'm saying that there's a more coherent and amenable way, and that in doing this, we can actually think of some of the positive ways that Sharia might influence and affect our world. So things about that are even lost amongst many Muslim traditions here in Scotland, the Church of Scotland and the Muslim Society of Scotland banded together to create a bank that would challenge predatory loans, right? Loans that charge 40% interest in a couple weeks, payday loans, what they're called. So here's something that Muslim tradition and the Christian tradition can come together to do. And I also looked at some of the ways that this could happen around migration. Now, I also want to affirm some of the challenges around dhimmihood, blasphemy, etc. But the attempt of the book, I know I'm talking too long, is essentially to say, what does it mean for me as a Christian theologian to take seriously Islamic thought as a dialogue partner in developing my own Christian theology of public law? What I conclude with is a position that is deeply Christian. It's grounded in claims about Jesus of Nazareth. It's rooted especially in a reading of Peter's sermons in the first few chapters of Acts, and looking at the ways in which he discusses public law and the crucifixion. So I'm not expecting a Muslim to follow my position, but the model of comparative theology is to say we can think alongside each other and track each other's points so that our disagreements can be done well. And the final thing is that I actually suggest that one of the things that I'm a Protestant, as you can tell, of a Reformed backing. And one of the things I think that Muslim or Islamic theology and Jewish theology as well has done about law is saying that law is not fundamentally about principles, but about concrete judgments and particular cases. And that Christian theology, especially here in the United States or in the UK, I'm not in the United States, as an American, has been too preoccupied with general appeals and been unwilling to realize that justice is worked out in particular cases and in particular legal renderings and formulations, right? So rather than, I use the example of the migration crisis in Europe, which I was on a task force for 3 years for, visiting Lampedusa, Italy, Hungary, Germany, etc. What you saw happening is many mainline churches were very happy to write statements saying, care for the stranger, care for the poor. But no one wanted to say anything about the actual laws that influenced refugees and the nations that were debating about hosting them. No one was willing to say, this law against rescuing people at sea is unjust, or indefinite detention in the United Kingdom is not just. There should be a judgment needs to be rendered in a certain amount of time. And I actually think if we want to talk about public law and justice, we shouldn't talk just generally about care for the stranger. We should risk making particular judgments about particular cases, something that you see happening in things like Catholic social teaching from time to time, and some of the church papers. But that's essentially, in a very broad brushstroke, the argument of the book.
Thank you so much, Josh. That's a very good summary of the book, because most of us haven't read it yet. I just want to lead with a question about, you brought up Ibn Taymiyyah's criticism of the absence of perhaps practical law in Christianity from the eternal decrees. Now, was Ibn Taymiyyah reacting against kind of this medieval Western Christian theology, where there is distinction between civil law and ecclesiastical law, kind of the Thomistic framework with all these nice scholastic divisions? Or was he reacting against more of the Eastern Orthodox theology, where the church and state are kind of united, and therefore, look, you have the secular power over the church and you have nothing to say, you completely bowed to secularism? What was he reacting to at the time? Thanks.
Yeah, so the direct thing that he's responding to is a letter that was written by someone named Paul of Antioch. That was essentially a letter. It's one of these, like, I traveled around the Mediterranean and I asked everybody what the true religion is, and it turns out it's my religion. It's one of these kind of things. It's got some really interesting things. It's written in Arabic by, we think, originally a Melkite, so a Byzantine Christian, and it's circulated. The first response comes from Al-Gharafi in Cairo. It's then redacted later and added to by some Christians on the island of Cyprus. Those Christians, some people think, are Nestorian. And then it's sent to Damascus, where it is responded to by two different people, Al-Damashqi and Ibn Taymiyyah. So the direct letter seems to be from an Eastern Christian, either a Melkite or a Nestorian, Eastern Church of the East. However, it is important to note that he's writing after the Mongol invasion and after a series of crusades, and it's assumed that while his primary knowledge would be of Eastern Christianity, he's had increasing awareness of Western Christianity and Latin forms of Christianity. When you look at the Christological sections of the text, he's very well aware of the differences between Monophysites, so-called Nestorians, and Chalcedonians. But we're not sure exactly. I do think, from my own reading, it could apply both to those models of Christianity that are more, let's say, just post-Justinian, and those models of Christianity that are more two swords models, whether that's Catholic or Protestant.
Oh, fascinating. Thank you. I'll open the floor to the others. Otherwise, there are too many questions from me.
I have a couple of questions, Josh. First, I think this is more promotional stuff for your book. What surprises that did you find when you wrote, this is originally your dissertation that you did for your PhD, and then you turned many years later into a publication. What was surprising for you when you wrote as a dissertation, and then when you look back for publication, that you found something new in the meantime, between the time? That's yeah. One. And the second question is, can we have, in Christianity, in Christian faith, do we have a parallel between Sharia and what we have in Christianity?
Yeah, I'll start with the second one, and then I'll do the first one. I mean, I think one of the challenges that I try to lay out in the book, and I try to talk about this in chapters 4 and 5, is essentially the Muslim solution to the problem of not having a Sharia is to have a Sharia, and one that looks more like Judaism or Islam. And they argue, a lot of the modern thinkers, and there's a host of them who do this, who say, you know, Western Christianity especially fails to stand up to secularism, fails to stand up to communism, materialism. Why? Because of the lack of Sharia. You know, and that if you want an integrated model of life, you go to Islam, which is, you know this story, right? Islam is the middle way between a lax Christianity and an overly rigid Judaism. This is their argument. Now, in the book, I say, how can I say that their diagnosis of some of the socio-political issues are right, but their solution is one I cannot follow? And it's one that I can't follow because in my reading of the scripture and the event of Jesus, that's not on the table for us, right? So whether that's Acts 15, whether that's Paul's discussion of circumcision, I'm not with them at saying Paul and Acts corrupted the story. So what I try to say in the book is saying, look, I know you can't follow me, but you can follow the logic of why I want to be obedient to my scriptures. And so read along with me. And interestingly, I've had more Christian, more Muslim readers so far than I've had Christian readers. Try as a Muslim to follow my logic of how I read scripture, because we're not going to have a law that is your kind of law. But that said, Christian theology, as Wolfhard Pannenberg says, has never really solved the issue of the law, because it is, on the one hand, you have the abolishment of the law, the curse of the law, etc. But then you also have, in the New Testament, Jesus didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. The law will never pass away. There is a new law of Christ, right? And a lot of chapter 5 with Bart is to say, how have we made sense of this? What is this new law of Christ? And what is its socio-political import? Now, we don't have a Sharia, and we're not gonna have a Sharia. Well, at least as it's modernly construed. However, if you take the older meaning of the term, which was quite common in the medieval period, it wasn't until, I think, the Ottomans in the 18th and 19th century that Sharia became only a Muslim term. Before that, it's extremely common for Christians to talk about their own Sharia, Jews to talk about their Sharia, and that Sharia is much more like what we mean by the term religion than what we mean by the term law. It's more like a way of life, a way of existing in the world. So yeah, we're not going to have a Sharia, but the question is, what does it mean for a Christian to claim to live their whole life and not some parts of their life under the rule of God, recognizing the distinction between the law and the gospel and elsewhere? So that's to that question. To the first question, I mean, I started writing the book when I was living in Egypt and then in Ramallah in the West Bank, where I was when I was doing my PhD. And the vast majority of it was written there. And then towards the end, finished it when I was a lecturer and then later assistant professor at Union Presbyterian Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, PCUSA Seminary. And so I think I talk very candidly in the acknowledgments about the struggle of writing the book and the challenge of what it means to write the book in the context. I love acknowledgments, and I think it's a point where I can be a little more earnest and a little more honest. So I talk about the challenges of what does it mean to try to engage with Sharia when at that point of time, the civil war in Syria is going on, and you have groups like Jabhat al-Nusra, this is before ISIS, who are invoking the Sharia to commit horrible acts. Or what does it mean to think about the importance of public law when there's rising anti-migration rhetoric in the United States and in Europe. And so those were all existential challenges. And obviously I'm aware of my position, and I have a lot of Christian friends in the Arab world, especially in Egypt. So what does it mean for me to write about this in the safety of my own world when it's a very different situation for someone in Indonesia or someone in Egypt? And I tried in the revision to make that a lot clearer, to say, I'm not writing a Christian theology of Sharia for everyone. I'm aware that I'm writing as a Western Protestant with certain assumptions about the church and the state. I do hope it can be read and engaged by others, but it's going to have to be changed in really important ways. So that's one thing. And the main thing for the revision was making my own voice clearer, right? In a PhD, my supervisor, Ian McFarland, his own preferences for how you write are still kind of present. They're still there. But my own voice has changed, and trying to claim that a little more, to say, here's what I think, here's where we might go. And especially in the sixth chapter, and the longer exegetical engagement with the text is the biggest change. One more thing. I really don't like Christian theologians who have their pet theologian who then solves all the problems. And I like people like Karl Barth, and I have a chapter on Karl Barth, but I didn't want it to, and I think that his distinction between the law and the gospel, especially saying the gospel precedes the law, and the law is a form of the gospel, has some really important ways to help us engage with Islamic thought. And there's Jewish thinkers who have pointed this out, that I use Randy Rashkover especially. I think that's a really important insight. But I don't think Barth solves the problem. I think he has issues. And so one of the challenges, how do I not have this be, well, if you just read Barth right, or you just read Thomas Aquinas right, everything's going to be okay. And I struggle with that because I want to constructively engage with these thinkers. But I don't want to make it sound like, well, if you just, you know, if the stupid Muslims had just read, sorry, I mean, that's not what I mean. Like, if they had just read Karl Barth right, they wouldn't have this problem. That's not what I want to say. I think that you have to write theology in a reparative method too. So how do I engage with these thinkers? And that's something I still struggle with as a theologian.
Thank you.
Me next. Yeah, thank you for your presentation, Dr. Rust, and I learned a lot from that. I have a question. I don't know if you can answer it. It will be very good for me. It is about the significance of Sharia. What is the significance of Sharia for the the daily, let's say, the daily life of people, and like for, if I can bring it to a special context as Indonesian, what is the significance of Sharia for the life of Indonesian people, which is not even though it's a majority Muslim, but not a Muslim country. There are Christians there, there are other religions there. So it's kind of how meaningful is the Sharia for our life? And then that question comes to my mind because, as you say, Christianity will not have that kind of Sharia in our faith. We will not have it. But maybe we can have we have another way to generate something meaningful in daily life. So, I mean, Muslim can come to an end with Sharia, while Christianity can come to the same end without Sharia. We have our own, Christianity has our own law, let's say. Thank you.
Yeah, Thanks, that's a really helpful question. I think I don't want to speak for all Muslims everywhere, and there's a lot of debates right now in Islamic studies about has Western thinkers overemphasized Sharia as a religion. So obviously, what is Islam? This book by Ahmed criticizes this. I do think one of the things that I try to attend to in the book is that what a Muslim or many Muslims say or hear or understand with the term Sharia and what non-Muslims hear and understand with the term Sharia are night and day. So I'll use an example. Well, I have some family in the United States, in Texas, who are very worried because there were Sharia courts in Texas. So in their minds, there were these courts that were operating outside of the law and were maybe going to cut off people's hands for stealing, hadud punishments. What was really happening is that there was essentially a guy in a strip mall who was helping people navigate marriage and divorce and inheritance law. Right? And so for a Muslim to get married and divorced is under the Sharia. Whether that the state recognizes it or not, that's part of Sharia. When a Muslim prays 5 times a day, theoretically, how they prepare their body to be ritually pure, what they eat, those things are all Sharia. They're the first fourth of the Sharia. In fact, it is those things that are not changeable because they're given from God. Unlike the latter three quarters of the Sharia, which relate to interhuman relations, which the Islamic tradition has long recognized can be contested and disagreed about, right? So I would say that even whether or not a Muslim is thinking through, oh, what is the fiqh that allows me in Indonesia to have ritual ablution before I pray? When do I need to just wash my hands and my feet and my ears? And when do I need to take the entire bath? Well, this depends on, you know, certain things in terms of, I mean, not to get explicit, whether or not you've had sexual intercourse, whether or not you've used the toilet, what kind of ways, right? These things are just culturally regular parts of Muslim life. That's the Sharia. When they get married or divorced, how they carry on property law. So if they choose to drink or not to drink, I know many Muslims do drink, some of them just because they want to, some, Hanafi school especially, have a legal reason for this. The Quran itself only forbids date and grape alcohol, not all alcohol. So as long as I'm drinking beer or whiskey and it doesn't interfere with my prayers at certain times, then that's okay. So yeah, I think there, part of what I'm trying to say is what most non-Muslims are concerned about, let's be honest, are the hudud and state enforcement. So the criminal punishment aspects and issues related to religious freedom. And so part of the book is to say, we can debate that. And I still think there's an important point of doing it. But to debate that, you don't need to throw the entire Sharia out. Because in fact, there are many Muslims who have long debated this in the Islamic tradition. Far before modernity, far before pluralism and liberalism, there was already in the jurists a whole series of criteria that you needed to meet in order to enact the criminal punishments around, let's say, theft or adultery, right? For theft, we use this in a class I teach. You can't have been drunk, which is funny. You can, if you're drunk, you don't get your arm cut off because then you weren't in your right mind. It couldn't have been something left out, so you mistook it for something that could just be like normal. If you needed it to survive, or your people to survive, you shouldn't have your arm cut off, even though there'd be some other punishment. Similarly, with adultery, you would have to see intercourse would have to be witnessed by 4 different people, not just a rumor of it, right? So the system already created ways of being lenient. There's a hadith that says, you know, prefer leniency to stringency. So that's just to say, I do think whether Muslims in Indonesia recognize it or not, it's present. Now, that's different than saying there is, over the last especially 60 years, an increasing strand of Muslim political movements that argue that Sharia should be the enforced governmental law of the state, and that if this happens, true justice will come, right? And it's that group that has become the most dominant and loud voice, even though there's a whole variety of different ways of going about it. And so the book is essentially trying to engage both those traditions, but also other Muslim traditions. But in Indonesia, I mean, I'm not an expert on Southeast Asia, although I'm overly fascinated with it, especially over the last 4 years, and it's often used. I mean, I know within Muslim communities, there's a whole bunch of different debates between what happens in Sumatra or Aceh versus what happens in different parts of Java, and depending on different thinkers and different movements. When I was there in Indonesia, there was a whole emphasis on the ways in which the internet and transnational networks have increased the number of more Salafi jihadi groups that were there previously. So I think those are all things that you would have to say. I mean, you're talking about what, 180 million different Muslims in Indonesia, something like that? The largest Muslim country in the world. So I don't want population. I can't say what is all. The other point, I do think that there are areas of overlap that we can get to in a different way. But there's also areas of disagreement that challenge us. And then Christianity, one of my first theology teachers, Frank Tupper, when I was an undergraduate, I was a philosophy major. There happened to be one theology class while Wake Forest was waiting to start their divinity school. And so I took it as an elective on the providence of God. And he said something that stays to me to this day, which is that every theology has a soft underbelly, which means you got to live with the weakness of your position, right? So if you want to strongly emphasize the sovereignty of God, you've got to live with the questions about human freedom and the problem of evil. If you want to strongly emphasize like a process version, then you need to make sense of how can we be sure that God will make the world right. Similarly, when it comes to Christian and Muslim agreement, I say this actually in the conclusion, it may, like, the Christian commitment, especially the Protestant one, to the distinction between the law and the gospel, the freedom of the Christian and conscience, may mean that we just risk not making the kind of concrete judgments that need to be made. And we have to live with that because we've said that these other things are more important. But I've always been troubled by this. What's funny is I didn't plan to do Christian Muslim relations. I didn't plan to be a comparative theologian. I just wanted to be a regular good Protestant systematician. But I was always bothered by Luther's claim about vocation, that the hangman should just be a good hangman for the service of the state. And on the one hand, I love the Protestant argument that vocation there is no ontological hierarchy with ordination, that all of vocation is under the rule of God. I love that. But then I'm troubled by, but isn't there some judgment where the hangman needs to say no? That maybe this isn't, this civil act of goes against the gospel? And this has been something that's bothered me for 20 something years. And so the book is essentially using Islam to try to solve that problem. When do we say that this job, this position, this ethical position, as much as freedom of Christian we want to give, when do we say actually this compromises the central claim of the gospel? And that law helps us do that, is what I'm trying to suggest.
I have a question, actually. Maybe it's a continuation, I guess, from what Elia had. I wonder, I am not too familiar with Sharia, but from what I heard and from your explanation, basically Sharia gives this set of rules that's really particular for every cases, and it's very specific, written by the Muslim in their specific time frame and context, right? Does it means when we apply Sharia, it means there will be no more room for diversities of cultures and context? So you know what I mean, like for Christianity, I think the from what I see, the beauty of Christianity in one sense, although we don't have that specific rules, it allows cultures to thrive, different richness of traditions. Does it mean for Islam, when we apply Sharia, there will be like this unified system, that one for all system?
Yeah, that's a huge question that has to do with a huge and historic debate within Islamic legal tradition. So what Sharia is essentially trying to do is to make judgments about concrete cases in front of us in light of the command and revelation of God. Oliver O'Donovan, a Christian theologian, in his book Ways of Judgment, essentially makes a similar argument that what Christians should do is think about thinking after God's judgments. So in that sense, I think that's a really important and aspirational thing, but that also means we recognize we're not rendering God's judgment. We're giving a witness to God's judgment. It's a contestable one. It can be wrong. It's provisional. It can be revised. It's indirect. It doesn't need to appeal to God or Jesus in order for it to still be a witness. This is my longer argument about those three terms that are really important in my book. They're clearly influenced by Barth, but with a strong revision by Pondenberg. When it comes to Islam, everyone agrees that all legal judgment should be rooted in the Quran and in Hadith, or the Sunnah, the sayings and examples of the Prophet Muhammad and his companions. The Quran doesn't give you a legal judgment on everything. In fact, it gives you very few legal judgments. The vast majority of the Quranic texts are much closer to these vague things about doing justice. The Hadith give you more, but they don't give you all, and they're not even, they could be interpreted in a variety of ways. So I'll give you an example of a Hadith, and it could be interpreted one or two ways. There's someone who commits adultery, who comes to the Prophet, confesses, says he wants to be saved, and so he wants to be stoned to death. And the Prophet says, "You've repented, go away." The guy comes back, says it again. Prophet again says, "Go away." Comes back a third time, and the Prophet says, "Okay," and stones him to death. Okay, what is the legal meaning of that Hadith in a new situation? Is it that if a person confesses, they should be given freedom and not have the Hudud put against them? You could easily interpret it that way. The Prophet himself does it twice, and that you should only enact it if the person confesses, if they themselves want it for their own salvation. The guy thinks, if I take this judgment on me, I'll be saved. That's one way you could interpret that Hadith, and ways that some jurists have. The other way is, well, the Prophet said, ends up allowing the stoning to death of this guy. I think it's a stoning. I'm not 100% sure. It is, yeah. That means no matter what the case is, even if the person confesses, you should do this. You could interpret it either way. So the Hadith themselves are contestable. But in addition, neither the Quran nor the Hadith talk about all things and all places. There's a debate. Is coffee against the law? Is it a stimulant? Is whiskey against the law? If I have this many, this much property, how do I adjudicate it? How much, if you have modern capitalism, how do you not take out interest? What do you do, right? These are all new things. And that in Sunni Islam, which I know better than Shia, there's four different schools of law that develop. And essentially, without simplifying it, They develop other tools, namely analogy, consensus, and also culture, right, as a way to interpret this. So the Hanafi school, which is the first to develop, is the most willing to allow local custom and local traditions to have some space. The Hanbali tradition, which is the last to develop and is often thought of as being close to some of the Salafi groups, wants to limit analogy, reason, consensus, and cultural practice as much as possible. So even within these four, you have a wide variety of options. But even if you are a Hanbali, you still have to make a judgment. You still have to say, how do I interpret this thing in this case? So while there is an aspiration to something that looks more uniform, I mean, Indonesia is a case in point. The ways in which Islamic legal practices are carried out in Aceh are going to be extremely different than they're carried out in Borneo or East Java or different parts, right? Because of different cultural, marital, and similar practices. Now you extend that out onto a much larger scale. You've got Muslims in Senegal who have a very, very different interpretation of this versus Muslims in Saudi. Even in the Arab-speaking context, which is where I'm much more familiar, the differences between what is considered permissible and normal Sharia in Egypt, in Saudi, and in Palestine are all extremely different. And there is theoretically some space. But I do think there is a dominant voice right now in many online forums that connect imitation of the Prophet with imitation of Arab culture and Arab practices. And so you see this increasing homogeneity that we're seeing across the world, not just in Islam, but in other traditions. And so you could see that as well.
Can I ask a question now? So again, thank you very much, Joss, for your excellent book. As someone who studied comparative theology, I really, really appreciate what you do, especially as you said in the beginning, it's not that many theologians engage with Sharia. Mostly like what I do is engage with systematic theology or, you know, concepts in Islam. So I really appreciate when you do a deeper reading of Sharia as a Christian and try to glean understanding for Christians. So in regard to that, my question would be related to the core of Sharia, or some scholar called like Maqasid Sharia. And I think this is something many Christians missing when they look into Sharia. Often people in Indonesia got a very negative image of Sharia because of the modern understanding of Sharia, like you said, or something imported from the West. You know, that kind of creeping Sharia in the Europe or United States imported to a place like Indonesia. So Sharia is definitely misunderstood a lot. And you mentioned about Hudud, and I remember very telling story about Umar who decided to halt the cutting the thief's hands at that time because there was a famine, so people were poor, and okay, even though the Quran permitted, we should not do it because the circumstances are not allowing us to do. So definitely Sharia takes a lot of contextual application, as you mentioned. However, Christians' understanding often very limited. So my question, one, for do you think that the learning of Sharia and especially Maqasid Sharia, trying to find the deeper understanding, that deeper principle of Sharia, would be helpful to not to reconciliate, but to just connecting Christians, especially in the West, who have difficulties with secularism? Because often Christian thought of what the law of the country or the law of the country as something unfamiliar to them. Like, let's say on the issue of abortion or on the issue of, you know, there are different issues that for Christian, this is not Christian. But if you look from the other side, if we really think this is about protection for women or, you know, so many of secular law might be reconcilable with Christian law, that says in a quote, Christian law. So that will be a good thing for Christians in the West. And as an Indonesian, I think many Indonesian Christians are too obedient to the law because of the concept that whatever happened by the decided by the government, that's God's ordination, right? While learning about Sharia, for me, it's a way for Christians to rethink. Not everything told you by the government is good for you, right? So I want you to comment on the secularism and Christian law, if you could do it, please.
Yeah, thanks for that. There's a number of issues that I'll try to address, and maybe I'll get to them. I think one of the things that I take in the introduction or the first chapter methodologically, both from Johann Baptist Metz, but also from Klaus von Stosch, is that a dialogue always includes others that are both there obviously and there implicitly. And the two other major dialogue partners at various points in my book are debates about political secularism and Judaism at different stages of the book. So I thought starting out it was just going to be Christianity, Islam, and political secularism. But as the argument developed, I realized I needed to engage with Christian views of Judaism, because if Christians can't have a coherent view of Halakha and Jewish law, which is much closer and much more grounded in our own shared scriptures, how can we have a coherent account of Islamic law? And we needed to address the anti-Semitism inherent in our own theologies if we're going to engage in that. So that's not to your question, but it's a recognition that that's an aspect of the book. But the political secularism runs throughout. And one of the arguments is to try to say, what does it look like to neither fall into what I call ardent secularism or sort of the hubris of a theocracy? And what, there's a whole bunch of options in between that. There's a whole bunch of theological options that Christians and Muslims have thought about, have practiced throughout the ages and even to this day. And so one of the things that I've found, and this may be just a Protestant issue, especially, you know, I'm more mainline than evangelical, although I grew up evangelical. The mainline, I think, has evaded its responsibility to think coherently about law in a way that the right in America has done a really good job about, wherever you stand on it, right? Like the emphasis of the last 30, 40 years on the Supreme Court, on judges, on courts as a means to engage has been much more vibrant amongst the religious right than it has the Protestant mainline, which is ironic because historically the Protestant mainline dominated the Supreme Court. It's only now that there's no single Protestant, like real Protestant mainliner left. So I think part of it is to say we just kind of assume this cultural idea that there's this thing called secular law, and it's kind of, it is related to Christianity in many ways, but it, as political theology has shown, it's indirectly so, right? It's not explicitly so. And it's often not, as you rightly note, grounded in what Christians claim is true about God as revealed in salvation in Christ and Spirit. And maybe this is my evangelical childhood, maybe this is my Bardianism, but I, you know, we live all of our lives in light of what God has done for us in and for us in Jesus. And so trying to think about what that means for political secularism and the law, and this sense of acquiescing to whatever the law is, as if Romans 13 is the only thing that's ever been said about public law in the whole of the New Testament. And I've often been very troubled by the ways in which Romans 13 is used as an appeal to justify children being separated from their parents at, I use this as an example in the book, in order to enforce state laws, Romans 13, to say, well, you were fleeing a war, but you can't do this. And so one of the things I try to argue in the final chapter is that we need to read Romans 13 in light of Acts 5 and the statements that, God has overturned. I try to read the resurrection as an overturning of human judgment, right? So I try to read the crucifixion and resurrection as legally, but not substitutionary legally, but saying this is human public law standing in judgment against God's kingdom and killing it. And the resurrection is an overturning and vindication of God's law and God's rule over and against what? Public law. It's public law that is being critiqued and judged. It is public law that is put under not just Jewish law, right? There's this strong emphasis. We have this tradition in Christianity of making it all about Jewish law that's under judgment. But if you read the text, they're handed over to someone outside of the law. What they mean by outside law is outside of Jewish law in Roman law. And so I try to give a theological reason for your Christian friends in Indonesia that would say there is a reason not to obey the government at times. The government can be ambivalent, right? But there's plenty of reasons to be involved in protest movements. And there's a long Christian tradition of doing this. And you can ground this not just in Romans 13, which is, to be completely honest, somewhat of an offhand appeal that Paul makes, versus Acts and and Acts 5, especially when Peter's saying, we won't obey you, we'll obey a higher law, which is his justification is grounded in the central event of Christianity, the death and resurrection of Jesus and his vindication. And what my book is trying to say is that should be the grounding of public law. Now, not directly in the sense that we enforce it, right? I still think there's wisdom in secularism. This is why Barth helps me, or Pannenberg helps me. I'm not really answering your question. I'm ranting about the gospel. Back to your point, yeah. I mean, I think politically there's a whole bunch of ways, and I think Muslims do this well, and I'm trying to suggest it, that we should reclaim some of the ambivalence in our relationship to the government. And I don't mean this in the faux persecution of American white Christians, right? Just because we have less power doesn't mean we're being persecuted. So that's not what I mean. But what I mean is to say a gospel that is for the sake of others, a gospel that divests itself of power for the sake of justice. And I'm trying to read, obviously, my politics are slightly more left than the American right. So I'm trying to push and say, here's a theological way to think about these sorts of things. But I grant that I take for granted some of my own biases about how politics function. I mean, being in the UK has been interesting because I do feel like my Americanness becomes even more present, the ways in which I do think that state churches or the Church of Scotland, which is not established but pretty much established, too often ends up doing the bidding of the government or reflects culture. So I'm, trying to hold together some of my more anti-establishment leanings with a strong recognition of the need for political engagement. So I don't want establishment, I don't want theocracy, but I also don't want a church that engages with civil life for the sake of Christianity. In this sense, I'm deeply Barthian, that God stands in judgment against religion. That our engagement with civil life is not for Christianity, but for our neighbor, but for justice, right? But for the oppressed, and not for our own sake. And my critique of the American right is that they're engaging with the law often for their own establishment, right? That it is, I'm not want to throw them under the bus. There's other things they do well, but too often engagement is for us, right? And I see that the rule of God is one that is not for us, but for the other, and that we are supposed to, as Luther says, and this I like, the freedom of the Christian is that once we stop worrying about our own salvation because we know we're justified in Christ, we're now what? We're freed up from the law, not so that we can ignore the law, but so that we can live and love and work for our neighbors, not being worried about our own salvation. The whole second half of the freedom of the Christian can be read, and I think Luther should have done this, in a radically interesting way, to say, once I'm not preoccupied with my religion, my salvation, my law, I'm freed up to engage in quests of justice and care for others. And for me in the book, I try to say, if Christianity, to a point that was raised earlier, if Christianity can exist and adapt and make judgments about American law, French law, Indonesian law, Nigerian law, as sometimes good and sometimes bad and sometimes ambivalent, we should be able to do the same thing about Sharia. That didn't answer you at all. It just got me, like, my preaching came out.
Amen.
There is a comment from Dr. Fariel Salem, if I want, and how do you take on this? Thanks for the wonderful summary of this book. Appreciate it. Your comments about the importance of engaging issues that are discussed on the basis of fiqh within the perspective of fiqhil reasoning. The blasphemy issue in Indonesia was a helpful example. I wonder, however, if by highlighting Islamic law as a form of engaging Islam, whether we are affirming Western biases of Islam as legalistic and giving legalistic approaches to Islam an overestimation.
Yeah, so I thanks so much for that question and for spending a little of your Saturday morning listening in. I completely am aware of this problem, and I try to spend a lot of chapter 2 looking at this. I compare two different Christian thinkers, Hans Küng and John Milbank. One who's a liberal who tries to sort of say Sharia is bad and we can agree about justice, and the other radical Orthodox who says Sharia is bad and Islam needs to change. And I try to suggest that both of them are reading Sharia as legalistic, and that we can think about, if you look at Sharia and fiqh, you can think about it in a much more dynamic way. As you yourself know, any fiqh issue has tons and tons of debates, tons of disagreements, and it isn't a hard and fast thing. I also try to engage with some other critiques and recognize that Sharia is not the whole of Islam. There's adab literature, so ethical practices. There's kalam, there's philosophy. Islam is not just Sharia. And am I giving an overrepresentation? Maybe, but I guess the hope of the book is to do the exact opposite, is to say, here is a way to engage with Sharia, not as legalism, but as dynamic, reason-based thinking about the nature of life in this world and as an act of politics. It's not the only thing Islam is. And I've written other things on Calvin and Ghazali on law, not as legalism, but as practices of the heart. I'm working on other aspects right now that are much more theological. So I don't want to say that's all it is, but I am annoyed by most Christian discussions of Sharia as legalistic. So that's part of what I'm trying to get after.
Arvin?
Oh, no, I had a slight follow-up question about your response in India, but what is the equivalence of Sharia in Christianity, but also responding to your Barthian move, which is to say, if you're comparing, what's his name, Al-Ashmawi, that Sharia should be interpreted in the perspective of Quran, then any public theology that we do should be interpreted in the light of Jesus Christ, right, this very Barthian move, then how would you avoid falling into the methodological setup that you have in the beginning, comparing between, you know, Milbank and Hans Küng? There's always a risk if you're too Barthian, then you'll fall into what Milbank is doing. There's the end of dialogue. This is the Christian. This is the Christian setup. This is how it should be. So what are your medications to prevent that from happening? Because it's very clear that that's not what you want.
Yeah, so the chapter on Bart, which is the fifth chapter, and then the start of the sixth, when I engage more with Pannenberg, is also part of like a series of essays that I wrote on Bart and religion and engagement. So there's a chapter in the Oxford Handbook on Bart, Religion, and Religions that I wrote, and a chapter on Bart and Ghazali in a Comparative Theology and Bart book that was published by Fordham Press. And the three of them are kind of companion pieces in my own approach of how can I be somewhat Bartian. I mean, I'm in between Bart and Schleiermacher. I'm probably more Schleiermacherian now than when I wrote this book. One is that Bart's own critique of religion needs to be turned on himself and on Christianity in more clear ways than he does in 17:3. So if you know Bart, he famously says that all of religion is under God's judgment. It is nonetheless lifted up and used as a tool of revelation, although it's human idolatry working at self-justification, and that includes Christianity. But in 17:3, he says, nonetheless, God chooses Christianity as one that is both elect and damned in some ways. And Spence Ensminger, in his important book on Bart and religion, makes a similar comment that one of the most important ways that we can think about this is that Bart needs to be used against himself in this way. So that's one aspect. The other is that in his essays on church, state, and civil society, or church and civil communities, he does a very good job, I think, of this category of witness, which is really important to me. I'm writing a current book on witness as a method for Christian-Muslim theological exchange, because witness is a term that's really key to the Islamic tradition in the development of the Hadith, in the account of the Shahada, one who bears witness. And so this idea that human witness is not the divine itself, although I do think that Bart has in his own theology, I say this in the Oxford Handbook thing, a tendency towards triumphalist particularity, and that I think his critique of natural theology and his critique of apologetics can just as easily lend itself to what I call a humble particularity, and that doesn't mean giving up on my particularity, but I do think Bart has a tendency, just because of his own personality, the context in which he's writing, to think about his own theology as, even though he recognizes it's human, there's sometimes it doesn't feel like that in his rhetoric. And so that's some of the ways I'm trying to do that. But then strongly, I think there's a strong importance that I put on this category. I haven't talked about this much today, that the secular is not understood as an empty space, but as a contested time. And that, in fact, the Islamic tradition and the Christian tradition alike recognize there's a moment of revelation that establishes God's rule or makes it known, whether that's the cross or whether that's the Quran. And there's a future moment of eschatological consummation when this rule is not only revealed, but is all in all. And that we live in what Joe Jones calls the long and meaningful middle between these two things. And that what law is about, what Christian life is about, is this contested time, right? Not empty space, right? Where God's rule is not absent, but we have the revelation that we're trying to make sense of, but we don't have the, God's rule is complete, but we don't see now, we see through a glass darkly, or we're not in the hereafter, to use Muslim terms, we're in a journey. And so thinking about our engagement in that period as occupying that time, occupying that epistemic humility, becomes to me very important. I mean, one of the things that I think I said in an interview I did about the book in Dubai was, I'm trying to encourage both epistemic humility and prophetic critique. And those two things don't often come together, right? Prophetic critique often means I speak for God. And epistemic humility can often be like, well, let's just, you know, we don't know. But I think the two of those things going hand in hand are really important for how we might think about law and justice.
All right, thanks, Joyce. I'll let Nindyo field the questions. So there are more questions from YouTube and Facebook.
There are. And so let me show this from Sebastian. Thank you for the conversation. How should we think about the social justice movement within the church in light of the stated need for a better Christian public theology?
Yes, thanks for that, Sebastian. I do think, depends on what you mean by the social justice movement. I do think that there should be, that Christians and other people should be involved in engaging with public law and political engagement for the sake of justice and for the sake of concerns for the poor, for the marginalized, for those that are disinherited. Now, the issue, of course, becomes those are all contested. And this is one of the things that I try to talk about in the book, that the law is often talked about in Christianity as if it's a static thing and a settled thing. But anyone who's gone to law school, anyone who's read the Islamic legal tradition, anyone who's engaged in debates, is that it is contested. It's changing. It is argued about. And I talk about it's both stable and supple, right? It needs to be stable enough across time, but it also needs to be supple enough to make sense of new movement. So insofar as I think that, obviously I haven't been in the States, I'm kind of happy about that, but I'll use examples of social justice engagement in Europe. And I have been really involved in migration debates. And I think that there are important ways in which the churches, whether individual theologians or churches, now this can cause huge issues, need to risk being more concrete in their evaluation of the local, of both the EU laws and their local national laws. I use the example of the Waldensians, Protestant Christians in Italy, but there was also Catholics involved in this that I had the chance to visit. The Italian government had outlawed rescuing migrants at sea, saying that this was against the law, that these would be compounded. And the Waldensian Christians issued a public statement saying this goes against God's law and international law, number one. Number two, they continued in the face of the law, knowing that they would be arrested, to nonetheless go out and try to rescue people who may be lost at sea. And I use this as an example that somewhere between a Hauerwasian, right? Like church as its own alternative community. I'm not that. I'm still too reformed for this. On the one hand, but so you're both engaging in the state, you're both engaging, but the church is also living in its own community or its own by its own ethos, but it's also doing so in solidarity with other groups that may or may not share its reality. And I think part of the recognition, say, of social justice movements in the United States, whatever one thinks of them, is that one has, if one is engaged in, let's say, addressing issues around the law and legality in terms of policing, which is obviously one of the biggest issues that has been at work in the United States for years, or the criminal justice, the facts of criminal justice, right, where disproportionate sentences are handed down to Black and Brown people, as well as poor people, right? So that's one of the things I talk about in the book, about the ways in which money becomes really important in the buying of justice. If Christians are to engage in this, there's no way you can engage in this and be pure. And this is my reformedness, or maybe it's even Lutheranness, that purity is not the aim of our public engagement. It's always a series of better and worse. There is no ideal. There is no Christian kingdom coming in America or anywhere else. And so it means making judgments and engaging. And you and I, if we had a longer conversation about social justice movements, we would probably disagree. And that's one of the things that I think is important to recognize. There is not a single Christian account. There are contestable and debatable accounts. And there isn't a clear path between what the Bible says and how we enact this in 21st century America or Indonesia or India or Sweden. But we have to engage in thinking and debating. But I think part of my argument is that we risk doing that not for the sake of purity, but for the sake of quests to bear witness to a God who is for us in Jesus Christ.
Thank you, Josh. Oh, this is a very interesting note from Lefrandi that he has purchased your book in the Kindle version.
He is in Indonesia.
Yeah. He's in Indonesia and he's writing his senior thesis on comparative theology. So he is looking forward to hearing more about comparative theology. So let me draw some questions from him regarding comparative theology. He asked you, do you get something good from Islam Sharia to understand scripture? And secondly, what is the benefit or maybe danger in a country engaging Sharia law and Christian law become public law? And he takes an example in France, how a teacher drew the prophets of Muhammad. Thoughts?
Yeah. Thanks so much for buying the book. It's really kind of you. If anyone else is out there and wants to buy the book, make me happy. I'd get like $1 from it one day. But recommend it to your library. Those are really good questions. As Arvin said, as others have said, I don't want there to be a Christian law of the state, nor do I want there to be an Islamic law of the state, because I think that usurps both the nature of our world as it now is constituted in terms of religious and social pluralism. In this sense, I am still a political secularist, political liberal, maybe a little bit. And I think it also mistakes modern state law for divine law. You know, in this sense, I'm trying to maybe chart some space between Luther's two kingdoms and a certain reading of Calvin's Geneva that is like somewhere between this. I think Calvin has a right instinct to try to say the whole of our lives are to be marked by the gospel and to be reformed in light of the gospel. But I think there's also a danger of taking that too far. And I think Luther veers in the opposite direction, especially in the war with the peasants and other things where he acquiesces too much to the rule of the princes. So I don't, and you know, I grew up in the United States I was born in the late 70s and grew up in the 80s and 90s where the religious right and the sort of, I was very much in this world, the Christian America. And I think there's a whole bunch of problems about that far before Trump that have abandoned our witness to the gospel and mistaken Christian identity for American identity. So I don't want that kind of thing. And that's why I spent a lot of time, especially with Bart and Pannenberg, talking about the law as what I call indirect, right? That it doesn't depend on a religious establishment in order for it to have an analogical relationship to God's justice. And in fact, as Luther says, a just non-Christian, a just Muslim, can be a better ruler than a Christian ruler, right? Confession of faith doesn't justice make. So I don't want that, and I see a danger of that. And one of the things that I try to look at are Muslims who see a similar danger, not in Islamic having a public space, that's not what I want to say, but that in Sharia becoming the state law. Now, does Sharia and does Christian theological commitments intersect with public law? Yes. Should we make arguments about it? Yes. But this is a much longer conversation about the difference between classical governance and modern nation states that I get into in the book. that the apparatus for a modern state's laws are extremely different than classical versions. Classical versions gave you a lot more latitude. They were a lot less invasive in your life than they are now. I don't have, and I say this in the book, maybe this is to Sebastian's earlier point, I do recognize that there's a lot of space and a lot of varieties of different options that we could agree or disagree about in terms of how the church, the state, Islam, Judaism, laïcité, other things might be organized. I'm trying to rule out certain things, but then within this space, then we have a contestable argument. My own positions of how I want to read things are going to push in ways that are probably more politically left than other people may be comfortable with. But I recognize that this isn't authorized by God. It's, as Kathy Tanner said, me making judgments based on these certain situations and trying to render them in light of my and others' political analysis. Someone else's political analysis could be quite different. The danger, of course, is that we... So what I'm trying to say is, how do we say that our political analysis is rooted in our central convictions about God, but also recognize